Victor was drawn to the obvious delights, putrefying carcasses, the regurgitations of hawks and owls, but he could just as easily get worked up over a clump of shrubbery that seemed no different than the one beside it. He had his nose stuck deep in swamp grass one damp morning when John saw a dog emerge alone from the low-hanging mist farther up the trail. It was a barrel-chested dog with a short, brindled coat and a blunt pink snout, twice Victor's size, as big as a lab, but of no breed familiar to John. When it caught sight of Victor, it stopped for a moment, then advanced on stiffened legs.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Tobias Wolff is best known for his 1989 memoir, This Boy's Life, which as a movie starred Robert De Niro and a very young Leonardo DiCaprio. People who haven't read his short stories have, so far, missed the work of a master of the form. Wolff's new collection of short fiction is his first in 10 years. It's aptly titled Our Story Begins, and nearly all of the stories have been previously published, but perhaps not previously podcast. Tobias Wolff is a watchful writer who hones in on disturbing details and characters saddened by experience. In a New York Times review of Our Story Begins, Wolff was called a painful genius. But he's also someone who takes great pleasure in reading as an exhilarating experience. You'll hear him talk about biting into books and being fed by them, and he feeds us as readers. This recording of Our Story Begins was recorded in April 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
It's great to be here. See my faces of many friends in the audience here. I was talking last night with some people I was out to dinner with, and they started talking about whoever it was who first got them interested in reading, fired up their passion for reading. And one of the women at the table mentioned that for her it was Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And a fellow mentioned that for him it was Thomas Mann, reading The Magic Mountain made a reader of him for life. And I was getting a little smaller in my chair as this conversation went on, because in all honesty, as I was looking back, maybe they weren't reading those books at the age of 10 and 11. But the books that made a reader of me were a series of books written by a guy named Albert Payson Terjune. And he wrote books only about dogs and only from the point of view of collies. And he was way out there. And he had a bunch of collies, apparently. I was browsing in a bookstore and saw a biography of him, and he did indeed have this great pack of them, about over 20 of them. And for his novels, he would simply kind of meeny, meeny, miny, mo, choose one and write a novel from that dog's point of view. And he always referred to himself and just in these books simply as the master, which I always liked. But this was the writer who made me kind of stuff towels under the door when I was a kid to keep light from leaking out, stockpile extra batteries for my flashlight. And once you get bit, then, as Frost says, way leads on to way. You know, somebody said, if you like those books, you should read White Fang and Call the Wild. And then you find yourself reading, some of Hemingway's outdoor stories. And soon, without even realizing it, you've become a reader. So I fessed up to this influence. I mean, he really was amazing. One of his books that I remember had to do with a dog who had a very close relationship with his master, telepathically almost. And the master signs up for World War I. He's an officer, and he's overseas and gets wounded. He's lying in no man's land. And this dog intuits that master's in trouble. And, you know, it's all very well for Lassie to get Timmy out of a well at the next property, but no man's land, you know, when you're in New Jersey. But the dog manages to get himself to Belgium, and and master is saved. But anyway, said, well, you know, that's very charming and everything, but you probably weren't very much influenced by him. And I thought, well, I probably wasn't. But actually, one of the stories that I'm going to read tonight, without my even realizing it, as I was thinking about it later, probably was. I'm going to read two stories tonight, one quite short one from an early collection, and then I'm going to read another fairly short story and open things up for a conversation. This first story was published in my first collection some 27 years ago, and the second one is quite a recent story. First one is called Say Yes. They were doing the dishes, his wife washing while he dried. He'd washed the night before. Unlike most men he knew, he really pitched in on the housework. A few months earlier, he'd overheard a friend of his wife's congratulate her on having such a considerate husband, and he thought, I try. Helping out with the dishes was one way of showing how considerate he was. They talked about different things, and somehow got on the subject of whether white people should marry black people. He said that all things considered, he thought it was a bad idea. Why? She asked. Sometimes his wife got this look where she pinched her brows together and bit her lower lip and stared down at something. When he saw her like this, he knew he should keep his mouth shut, but he never did. Actually, it made him talk more. She had that look now. Why? She asked again and stood there with her hand inside a bowl, not washing it, but just holding it above the water. Listen, he said, I went to school with black kids, and I've worked with black people and lived on the same street with them, and we've always gotten along just fine. I don't need you coming along now and implying that I'm a racist. I didn't imply anything, she said, and began washing the bowl again, turning it around in her hand as though she were shaping it. I just don't see what's wrong with a white person marrying a black person, that's all. They don't come from the same culture as we do, he said. A person from their culture and a person from our culture could never really know each other. Like you know me, his wife asked. Yes, like I know you. But if they love each other, she said. She was washing faster now, not looking at him. Oh boy, he thought. He said, don't take my word for it. Look at the statistics. Most of those marriages break up. Statistics. She was piling dishes on the drain board at a terrific rate, just swiping at them with the cloth. Many of them were greasy, and he could see flecks of food between the tines of the forks. All right, she said, what about foreigners? I suppose you think the same thing about two foreigners getting married. Yes, he said. As a matter of fact, I do. How can you understand someone who comes from a completely different background? Different, said his wife, not the same like us. Yes, different, he snapped, angry with her for resorting to this trick of repeating his words so they sounded crass or hypocritical. These are dirty, he said, and dumped all the silverware back into the sink. The water had gone flat and gray. She stared down at it, her lips pressed tight, then plunged her hands under the surface. Oh, she cried and jumped back. She took her right hand by the wrist and held it up. Her thumb was bleeding. Anne, don't move, he said. Stay right there. He ran upstairs to the bathroom and rummaged in the medicine chest for alcohol, cotton, and a Band-Aid. When he came back down, she was leaning against the refrigerator with her eyes closed, still holding her hand by the wrist. He took the hand and dabbed at her thumb with the cotton. The bleeding had stopped. He squeezed it to see how deep the wound was, and a single drop of blood welled up, trembling and bright, and fell to the floor. Over the thumb, she stared at him accusingly. It's shallow, he said. Tomorrow you won't even know it's there. He hoped that she appreciated how quickly he'd come to her aid. He had acted out of concern for her with no thought of getting anything in return, but now the thought occurred to him that it would be a nice gesture on her part not to start up that conversation again. I'll finish up here, he said. You go and relax. That's okay, she said. I'll dry. He began to wash the silverware again, giving a lot of attention to the forks. So, she said, you wouldn't have married me if I'd been black. For Christ's sake, Anne. Well, that's what you said, didn't you? No, I did not. The whole question is ridiculous. If you had been black, we probably wouldn't even have met. You would have had your friends, and I would have had mine. The only black girl I ever really knew was my partner in the debating club, and I was already going out with you by then. But if we had met, and I'd been black, then you probably would have been going out with a black guy. Let's say I wasn't, she said. Let's say I'm black and unattached, and we meet and fall in love. He glanced over at her. She was watching him. Look, he said, taking a reasonable tone, this is stupid. If you were black, you wouldn't be you. As he said this, he realized it was absolutely true. There was no possible argument against the fact that she would not be herself if she were black. So he said it again. If you were black, you wouldn't be you. I know, she said, but let's just say. He took a breath. He had won the argument, but still felt cornered. Say what? He asked. That I'm black, but still me, and we fall in love. Will you marry me? He thought about it. Well, she said, and stepped close to him. Will you marry me? I'm thinking, he said. You won't. I can tell. You're going to say no. Let's not move too fast on this, he said. There are lots of things to consider. We don't want to do something we might regret for the rest of our lives. No more considering, yes or no. Well, since you put it that way, yes or no. Jesus, Anne, all right, no. Thank you, she said, and walked from the kitchen into the living room. A moment later, he heard her turning the pages of a magazine. He knew she was too angry to be actually reading it, but she wasn't snapping through the pages like he would have done. She turned them slowly, as if she were studying every word. She was demonstrating her indifference to him, and it had the effect he knew she'd intended. It hurt him. He had no choice but to demonstrate his indifference to her. Quietly, thoroughly, he washed the rest of the dishes. Then he dried them and put them away. He wiped the counters and the stove and scoured the linoleum where the drop of blood had fallen. While he was at it, he decided, he might as well mop the whole floor. When he was done, the kitchen looked new, just as it had when they were first shown the house, before they had ever lived here. He picked up the garbage pail and went outside. The night was clear, and he could see a few stars to the west, where the lights of the town didn't blur them out. On El Camino, the traffic was steady and light, peaceful as a river. He felt ashamed that he'd let his wife get him into a fight. In another 30, 40 years, they'd both be dead. What would all that stuff matter then? He thought of the years they had spent together and how close they were and how well they knew each other. And his throat tightened. His face and neck began to tingle. Warmth flooded his chest. The house was dark when he came back inside. She was in the bathroom. He stood outside the door and called her name. He heard bottles clinking, but she didn't answer him. Anne, I'm sorry, he said. I'll make it up to you, I promise. How? She asked. He wasn't expecting this. But from a sound in her voice, a level and definite note that was strange to him, he knew he had to come up with the right answer. He leaned against the door. I'll marry you, he whispered. We'll see, she said. Go on to bed. He undressed and got under the covers. Finally, he heard the bathroom door open and close. Turn off the light, she said from the hallway. What? Turn off the light. He reached over and pulled the chain on the bedside lamp. The room went dark. All right, he said. He lay there, but nothing happened. All right, he said again. Then he heard a movement across the room. He sat up, but couldn't see a thing. The room was silent. His heart pounded, as it had on their first night together, as it still did when he woke at a noise in the darkness and waited to hear it again. The sound of someone moving through the house, a stranger. Most of the time, when I have finished a story and it's been through several drafts, I can hardly remember how it reached the form that it's in at the end. The story I'm going to read now, I do have it being quite recent, I can talk for just a couple of minutes when I'm through reading it about just how it evolved and reached this particular version that it's in. It's called Her Dog. When Grace first got Victor, she and John walked him on the beach most Sundays. Then a chow chow bit some kid, and the Parks Department restricted dogs to the slough behind the dunes. Grace took Victor there for years, and after she died, John stepped in and maintained the custom, though he hated it back there. The mushy trail hedged with poison oak, baking flats of cracked mud. The dunes stifled the sea breeze, leaving the air still and rank, seething with insects. But Victor came alive here in spite of himself. At home he slept and grieved, yet grief could not deaden the scent of deer and porcupine, of rabbits and rats and the little gray foxes that ate them. Dogs were supposed to be kept on the leash for the sake of the wildlife, but Grace had always left Victor free to follow his nose, and John couldn't bring himself to rein him in now. Anyway, Victor was too creaky and cloudy-eyed to chase anything. If he did catch some movement in the brush, he'd lean forward and maybe, just to keep his dignity, raise a paw. Hey, that's right, run along there. And then go back to smelling things. Victor was drawn to the obvious delights, putrefying carcasses, the regurgitations of hawks and owls, but he could just as easily get worked up over a clump of shrubbery that seemed no different than the one beside it. He had his nose stuck deep in swamp grass one damp morning when John saw a dog emerge alone from the low-hanging mist farther up the trail. It was a barrel-chested dog with a short, brindled coat and a blunt pink snout, twice Victor's size, as big as a lab, but of no breed familiar to John. When it caught sight of Victor, it stopped for a moment, then advanced on stiffened legs. "Scram," John said, and clapped his hands. Victor looked up from the grass. As the dog drew near, he took a step in its direction, head craned forward, blinking like a mole. "Huh? Huh? Who's there? Somebody there?" John took him by the collar. "Beat it," he said to the dog. "Go away." But the dog came on. Slowly now, almost mincing, with an unblinking intentness. John stepped in front of Victor to break the dog's gaze and force himself on its attention, but instead it left the trail and began to circle him, eyes still fixed on Victor. Victor gave a grumble and strained forward against his collar. The dog came closer, too intent. It seemed to be gathering itself. John reached down and scooped Victor up and turned his back on the dog. He rarely had occasion to lift Victor and was always surprised at his lightness. Victor lay still for a moment, then began struggling as the dog moved around to face him. "Go away, damn you," John said. "Bella, whoa, Bella," a man's voice, sharp, nasal. John looked up the trail and saw him coming. Shaved head, wrap-around sunglasses, bare arms sticking out of a leather vest. He was taking his sweet time. The dog kept circling John. Victor complained and squirmed impatiently. "Put me down, put me down." "Get that dog away from us," John said. "Bella, he won't hurt you." "If he touches my dog, I'll kill him." "Whoa, Bella." The man sauntered up behind the dog and took a leash from his back pocket. He reached for the dog, but it dodged him and cut back in front of John. "Shame, Bella. Shame on you. Come back here right now." The man put his hands on his hips and stared at the dog. His chest was bare and pale under the open vest. Beads of sweat glistened on the top of his head. "Get control of that dog," John said. He turned again, Victor still fidgeting in his arms, the dog following. "He just wants to make friends," the man said. He waited until the dog's orbit brought him closer, then made a lunge and caught him by the collar. "Bad Bella," he said, snapping on the leash. "You just have to be everybody's friend, don't you?" John set Victor down and leashed him and walked him farther up the trail. His hands were shaking. "That dog is a menace," he said. "Bella, Jesus." "It means handsome," the man said. "No," John said, "actually, it means pretty, like a girl." The man looked at John through his bubbly black shades. How did he see anything? It was irritating. "I thought it meant handsome," he said. "Well, it doesn't. The ending is feminine." "What are you, a teacher or something?" The dog lunged against its leash. "We're going," John said. "Keep your dog away from us." "So, are you a teacher?" "No," John lied. "I'm a lawyer." You shouldn't have said that about killing Bella. I could sue you, right?" "Not really, no." "Okay, but still, you didn't have to get all belligerent. Do you have a card? This friend of mine had his film script totally ripped off by Steven Spielberg." "I don't do that kind of law." "You should talk to him. Like D-Day? You know, all those guys on the beach?" "Exactly the way my friend described it. Exactly." "D-Day happened," John said. "Your friend didn't make it up." "Okay, sure, but still." "Anyway," John said, "that movie was years ago." "Oh, so you're saying statute of limitations." The opening notes of Ode to Joy shrilled out. "Hang on," the man told him. He took a cell phone from his pocket and said, "Hey, let me call you back. I'm in kind of a legal conference here." "No," John said. "No, you can talk. Just please keep Bella on the leash, okay?" The man gave the thumbs up, and John led Victor away, up into the mist the other two had come out of. Right away, his skin felt clammy. The bugs were loud around his ears. He was still shaking. Victor stopped to squeeze out a few turds, then looked up at John. "My savior, I guess I should be panting with gratitude, licking your hand." "No need." "How'd you put it?" "I'll kill him if he touches my dog." "What devotion. Almost canine." Victor finished and made a show of kicking back some dirt. He raised his head and tested the air like a connoisseur before starting up the trail, feathery tail aloft. I could have handled him. Maybe. He wasn't going to do anything. "Anyway, since when do you care? It's not like you even wanted me. If it hadn't been for Grace, those guys at the pound would have finished me off." "It wasn't you I didn't want, you in particular. I just wasn't ready for a dog." "I guess not, the way you carried on when Grace brought me home. What a brat." "I know. All your little conditions for keeping me. I was her dog. All the feeding, all the walking, picking up poop, baths, trips to the vet, arrangements with the kennel when you went out of town. Her responsibility." "I know. Her dog. Her job to keep me out of the living room, out of the study, off the couch, off the bed, off the Persian rug. No barking, even when someone walked right past the house." "I know, I know. And when they kicked me off the beach, remember that? No way you were going to get stuck back here. No, Grace had to walk me in the swamp while you walked along the ocean. I hope you enjoyed it." "I didn't. I felt mean and foolish. But you made your point. Her dog, her responsibility. You let her walk me in the rain once when she had a cold." "She insisted." "Then you should have insisted more." "Yes, that's what I think too now. I miss her. I miss her. I miss my Grace." "So do I." "Not like me. Did I ever bark at her?" "No, you did." "And she barked back. We disagreed sometimes. Couples do." "Not Grace and Victor. Grace and Victor never disagreed." "Did I ignore her?" "No, you ignored her." She would call your name and you would go on reading your paper or watching TV and pretend you hadn't heard. Did she ever have to call my name twice? No. Once and I'd be there, looking up at her, ready for anything. Did I ever want another mistress? No. You did. You looked at them in the park, on the beach, in other cars as we drove around. Men do that. It didn't mean I wanted anyone but Grace. Yes, you did. Maybe for an hour, for a night. Then I loved her more than you. I loved her with all my heart. You had no choice. You can't be selfish. But we men, it's a wonder we forget ourselves long enough to buy a birthday card. As for love, we can love, but we forget. I didn't forget, not once. That's true. But then you missed out on being forgiven. You never knew how it feels to be welcomed home after you've wandered off. Without forgiveness, we're lost. Can't do it for ourselves. Can't take ourselves back in. I never wandered off. No, you're a good dog. You always were. Victor left the trail to inspect a heap of dirt thrown up by some tunneling creature. John unclipped him and waited as Victor circled the mound, sniffing busily, then stuck his nose in the burrow and began to dig. To watch him, in his forgetfulness of everything else, was John's pleasure, and this is where he found it, Sundays in the bog with Victor. He looked up through a haze of insects. A buzzard was making lazy circles high overhead. Riding the sea breeze, John could not feel down here, though he could faintly make out the sounds it carried from beyond the dunes of crying gulls and crashing waves and the shrieking children who fled before them. Victor panted madly, hearing none of this. He worked fast for an old fellow, legs a blur, pawing back clumps of black earth. He lifted his dirty face from the hole to give a hunter's yelp, then plunged back in. Thank you. Thank you. I'll just talk for a moment about this story and just for a moment to describe how at least I recall this story evolving. You know, as you go on in years, you start to lose people who are close to you. And inevitably, you find yourself thinking back to times when you wish you had done things a little differently. Those moments you can't recall because they're gone now. And those little regrets and those little pools that you revisit again and again and that you can't ever, seems like, quite get released from because the other person really isn't there to release you, as only they can. So I was imagining what it must be like for this man to have so recently lost his wife and the kinds of things that one would be thinking about in such a case. And in an original draft, I had mention of children, but I took the mention of the children out because I wanted him to feel at that moment in this story, I want the reader to feel as he feels that this is all he has left of his wife, is this dog she loved so much and loved her so much, and to concentrate that emotional nexus right there. And so when the dog is threatened, or maybe even not threatened, he may be just as friendly as this fellow says, though I have to say that when big dogs descend on me and my dog, and I'm told that the dog only wants to make friends, I don't like it. But anyway, nevertheless, he feels that threat, obviously, very keenly. And in the first versions of the story, I had him walking on, and that this near brush with losing yet something else of his wife causes him to go back in time, to think about those things, to rehearse those regrets. And I thought it was emotionally true, but it, as a story, felt static to me in some way. I know there are other dog owners in here because I know they're dogs, and they are certainly under the illusion, as I am, that their dogs talk to them. And so I was thinking, well, you know, what if I began to phrase this whole reflection as a conversation? Now, the conversation with the other fellow in here is put in quotation marks to indicate that it's an actual conversation. Between him and the dog, it is not. I think that most readers will understand that this is truly a conversation that he's having with himself, but figured differently, just expressed differently on the page. And, you know, when I finished, I kind of liked it that way rather than the other way. And at the same time, I understood that it could seem a little forced or contrived. But in the end, I just decided to go with that because I have no other talking dogs in my work, and I really wanted to have one. And so Albert Payson Terhune is resurrected in me now at this age, and all those nights I spent under the covers have finally found a purpose. But, well, I'll conclude with that and open this up for questions.
I was curious, since you did write this memoir that is so popular before the age of memoir, and I could be completely ahistorical in this, but in your work in particular, what intrigues me is how porous it seems and playful these themes and obsessions and characters between your fiction and your memoir.
I mean, that I'm certainly have certain obsessions that, of course, just come up again and again because that's what obsessions do. But, and they come up in both the fiction and the nonfiction. But I have to say, I make a very clear distinction between the two. I was talking to somebody 2 days ago who said something along the lines of, and he did not mean it as an insult. He said, well, of course, you know, you fiction writers, you're just glorified liars, really, and really expert. And I really take exception to that. I don't believe that's what I do with my life. I actually think that the fiction writers I know, the serious people I know who write fiction, are real truth seekers. And they try to get there through the agency of the imagination because sometimes the facts themselves don't quite get you there. They'll give you the facts, but somehow not the truth. And for that reason, a book like All Quiet on the Western Front will give you a much truer sense of what it was like viscerally, moment by moment, to live through that experience than any number of histories I've read of World War I. But in writing a memoir, one can't allow oneself this liberty as if there really were no difference. And I mean, some of these hoaxes, I think readers have only themselves to blame that these books were taken seriously. There was a book published in Europe that I'm particularly fond of, written by a woman named Misha De Fonseca, who claimed that in 1940s Europe, she was raised by wolves. And this book actually received serious attention for a while until, lo and behold, it was found not to be true. And, you know, anyone who took that book seriously deserves everything they get, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, if you as a writer are aware of inventing as you write a story, even that's one close to your memory, you are not writing a memoir. You are writing fiction. And what's wrong with that? I mean, nobody ever talked about the great American memoir. They talk about the great American novel. It's a noble form. You got to keep these things straight. Now, you know, in my own case, I sometimes felt when I was growing up as if I was being raised by wolves, but I certainly knew it was a metaphor, you know?
Well, actually, the reason I was thinking of that question as it pertained to your work is I finished last night William Maxwell's book, So Long, See You Tomorrow.
Oh, that is such a great book. This is William Maxwell's great, great novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow. I think it's one of the great novels written since the war. It's very short, 120, 130 pages. It is a masterpiece. And in it, he certainly uses all the means at his disposal to suggest to the reader that the story he's telling really happened to him. I mean, a lot of the events correspond to events in his life. He lost his mother in that terrible influenza epidemic after World War I. His father remarried, caused catastrophic kinds of feelings of desolation and loss in him that he never ever got over. And it's an account of that time in his life, except that a lot of it is made up. But he drags little red herrings. He says, like, this novel or this memoir, whatever it is I'm writing. And he does allow you and invite you to believe that he's writing a memoir because he's doing what storytellers have always done. He wants you to enter that world with all your credulity intact. You want to believe that it's really happening. But on the cover of that book, it says a novel. And the reader must pay attention to that word. And you will realize as you read on that it is indeed a novel that he's written, and it's an amazingly artful novel that uses all the appearances of a memoir to achieve great truthful aims. It's just a wonderful, wonderful book. Why the short story rather than the novel? I don't really have a preference, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've written a short novel, I've written a regular novel, I've written a novel that I never admit I've written. I've written a couple of memoirs that are long narratives. So I like the long narrative form. I read it a lot. Right now, the book I'm reading and absolutely loving is Richard Price's new novel called Lush Life. The last book I read before that was a book by the great Austrian writer Joseph Roth, a book called The Radetzky March, which I absolutely recommend to everybody. It's a brilliant book. So I love reading novels. I love reading short stories. Sometimes, you know, a story just builds itself up in me, you know, and something happens that seems to be the best way to express that is in the short story form, and that's happened again and again to me. But, you know, I'm working on a longer piece now, and who knows what I'll work on in the future. But I will talk, though, about the story form, what I love so much about it. Somebody once described the novel form as a prose narrative of a certain length that has something wrong with it. And just by its very length, novels are more apt to fall into digression and that sort of thing. And I mean, if you think, for example, about that great novel, Moby Dick. Now, Moby Dick is a truly great novel. Its vision of the world, its language, the capaciousness of the story. It's a great novel, but it's also a bad novel. Melville forgets after about 100 pages that his narrator is not him, but a character named, we don't even know his name. He says, call me Ishmael, but that probably means that isn't his name. And he goes off on this, you know, 120-page digression in his own voice. And then kind of the light bulb goes off, and he says, oh, yeah, God, Ishmael's narrating this, and he goes back to him, and we get back into Ishmael's life. And it is such a great novel that it can somehow overcome that. But let's, you know, for the sake of argument, say that, you know, this is not this as an aesthetically finished piece. There are faults that could be found with it. But when you think of something like Joyce's story, The Dead, or, you know, Chekhov's Lady with Pet Dog, or his story, Joseph, or if you think of Catherine Ann Porter's story, Flowering Judas, or her story, Theft, or Flannery O'Connor's Good Country People, Raymond Carver's Cathedral, Ernest Hemingway, just about anything by him, any story by him, they achieve a kind of perfection. And that's very challenging to a writer, that possibility of perfection. And that may be one of the things that keeps me coming back to it, is the sense that, you know, maybe I can do something perfect. You can't control anything in this world, make anything perfect, but maybe this, you know? And so, yeah, and I think poets probably are drawn in that same way. It's a different kind of impulse maybe than draws someone to write a novel. And also I love the idea that if you really do it right, you can so construct a story that as this character just passes momentarily before the eyes of the reader, if you do it right, they can intuit something about the arc of that person's life, even the part that's not on the page, and the history that is underneath the page, all that kind of thing. It's a great art of implication, and it's very hard to do, and it's very satisfying if you think you've been able to pull it off. So, yeah, it's a beautiful form, the short story. And I will leave with that. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.